We have a fantastic evening of intellectual thinking ahead of us by two of what I consider to be the leading thinkers in the world on what it is that we're trying to create as better societies. I'm Ian Golden. I'm proud to be the director of the Oxford Martin School, which is an interdisciplinary group now of about 350 people working in Oxford to try and address the greatest challenges of the 21st century. And in these interdisciplinary teams, we try to think in original ways, and we try and bring great people together. And so it's a special privilege this evening to be able to welcome two of the leading thinkers in the world on issues of humanity, of the intersection of economics with society and philosophy. I'm also delighted to welcome this evening the family of James Martin, who very sadly died in June of this year. It was Jim who provided the inspiration for the Oxford Martin School. He is the Martin in our name, and we will be having a tribute to him with our building opening tomorrow. It's also a special week for us in that we yesterday launched the Now for the Long Term report, the Oxford Martin Commission for Future Generations, and I encourage you to look at that as it brings together some of the thinking that we're seeking to establish on how we overcome the greatest challenges. But tonight is about Professor Ned Phelps, the Nobel Prize winner from 2006, and in my view, the person in economics who's taught me more than anyone else I've known. He's currently the McVista Professor of Political Economy at Columbia University and the Director of the Center on Capitalism and Society. He thinks about economics in the way that many don't anymore. The book Mass Flourishing, How Grassroots Innovation Created Jobs, Challenge and Change is, in my view, a book which will, I hope, transform economics. This extraordinary paradigm-shifting book provides not only fascinating and fresh insights into the relationship between economic systems, innovation, and creativity, it draws on a dazzling array of historical and contemporary evidence. Ned shows that misguided economic ideas have fractured societies and stifled well-being. And he provides a framework for going beyond the current predicament in economics to create a better world. And I believe this book should be read by the widest possible audience. Rob Schiller, who got the Nobel Prize earlier this week for economics, said, "This book is what Adam Smith's Wealth of Nations should have been about, if it were to have been an even more important book. Mass Flourishing contains much history, but it focuses more on what society should do today and provides a call for action." Ned has got many, many honors across many different dimensions, but has in common with our discussant tonight the fact that he also is engaged in philosophy. He's the honorary patron of the University of Trinity's College Society of Philosophy. And like our other speaker this evening, Anthony Grayling, he's just a wonderful person, a kind, good human being. Anthony Grayling will be the discussant. A.C. Grayling, as many of you will know, and his book, The God Argument, is also one, his latest book, that I would commend to you. He's the master of the New College of Humanities and a supernumerary fellow at St. Anne's College, Oxford. He has a very strong connection with Oxford, having done his doctorate here and started his teaching career here, and then before going on to Birkbeck College at the University of London. He's written extremely widely. Many of you will be familiar with a number of his books. Those that do philosophy will certainly be familiar with his work across a very wide range of areas. But he's not only an academic and intellectual philosopher, he's deeply engaged in the real world too. He's been the honorary secretary of the British Principal Philosophical Association, the Aristotelian Society. He's very engaged with the UN Human Rights Council. He's been the vice president of the British Humanist Association. He's a patron of dignity in dying and an honorary associate of the National Secular Society. And he's also been a trustee of the British Library and many, many other things. It's a great pleasure to welcome to the stage Professor Edmund Phelps.
Distinguished guests, ladies and gentlemen, it's a great honor to be invited to speak to you here in the Sheldonian, and a great pleasure to be able to introduce my book, Mass Flourishing, to you. The book is a history of the rise and decline and a plea for a revival of what I call modern economies. They arose in the 19th century, first in Britain and America, around 1820, later Germany and France, and functioned well to the middle of the 20th century. Their success was the marvel of the world. They generated mass prosperity, material and non-material. Other nations, through trade flows and technological transfers, could tap into the material gains, the wage gains, but the non-material gains could not be transferred. Never before had such prosperity been in the reach of large and increasing numbers. Prior to the first modern economies, economic knowledge, hence productivity, was virtually stagnant, even in the economies that were the jewels of mercantile capitalism, Spain and Holland. The concept of job satisfaction was unknown in those times. For me, the solitary shepherd, bored with the routine and isolated from others, symbolized mercantile capitalism and all the pre-modern economies, really. The mass prosperity was brought by mass innovating. Though the historians trying to understand the prosperity spoke only of resources, efficiencies, and increasing returns to scale. In Britain and America especially, there was a welter of innovations in products and methods, large and small, not just headline innovations. In 1840s Britain, startup enterprises were forming so fast that Parliament, wearying of issuing charters, passed the Joint Stock Act of 1844. In an 1858 lecture, Abraham Lincoln, before he was president, said of America that there was a perfect rage for the new, a rage that I believe was rife among makers of products, not just users of products. Where did the ideas that led to innovation come from? Contrary to the German historical school and young Joseph Schumpeter, I'm referring to the first decade of the 20th century, the modern economy did not produce mass innovation through a succession of generally exogenous discoveries by scientists and navigators, and the commercial applications of those discoveries by entrepreneurs. Modern economies possess their own dynamism, their own desire, capacity, and scope to innovate. With this dynamism, they were capable, on a good day, of indigenous innovation, not just the exogenous innovation of the German historical school. This is so little understood, but it's so basic. The system of dynamism was more effective the more open it was to contributors down to the grassroots. And the modern economies were rather open to the grassroots. They produced a massive outbreak of tinkering, imagining, and experimenting by people in all walks of life. Human resources of initiative and imagination were devoted to innovating, not just producing and trading. Dynamism ran high to the middle of the 20th century. No wonder there was mass prosperity. No economy before drew on a large number and a wide range of a nation's minds. This dynamism required entrepreneurs and financiers, of course, just as the sporadic innovations of the mercantile period did. Their judgment and expertise was needed for innovation. Yet dynamism further required innovators, Innovators were needed with the insight, imaginativeness, and vision to dream up new products that might well work and change practice. Yet there's a belief that business activity in a free market can always be depended upon to possess the dynamism for indigenous innovation. There will always be entrepreneurs and innovators ready to go. In my thesis, the right stuff is required. Innovators often have to buck conventional thinking or to break away from traditional ties. Innovating also requires a social and political climate that is receptive to innovations despite the disruptions that they are apt to cause. Was this modern economy good? Propaganda to the contrary notwithstanding, modern economies brought an endless rise of material benefits, including rising productivity and wages, ever healthier products, rising longevity, decreasing poverty and pauperism, and widening inclusion. The most radical impact of the new economies, these modern economies, was non-material, changing the very nature of life and work where they took root. Individuals prospered from doing rewarding things. There were the experiential and existential rewards from working on new problems, gathering insights, imagining and creating novel things, testing them in the workplace, and trying them out in the marketplace. We might call this prospering. People were prospering who were having this wonderful, truly wonderful experience. The adventurous and exploratory spirit of these modern economies was reflected also in the arts of the period, as I argue in one of the chapters, in music, fiction, and painting. This transformation of the economy depended, of course, on the development of institutions that enabled dynamism, including various legal rights, laws governing corporations, and financial institutions. The real crux, though, and one not given enough weight until now, is the rise of what I call modern values, the spread of modern attitudes, precepts, and beliefs. These modern values can be grouped roughly under the headings of individualism, thinking for oneself, working for oneself, willingness to break from one's group, willingness to break with convention, vitalism, relishing interesting challenges, overcoming obstacles, taking initiative, acting on the world, and self-expression, imagining and creating, demonstrating a unique insight by testing it, voyaging into the unknown in the hopes of making a mark on the world. Perhaps it's useful to remark that these activities or aspirations are often said to be human rights. The slow accretion of these modern values over the centuries, the book argues, finally achieved the critical mass necessary to fuel the desire in individuals to innovate, to spur the capabilities required to innovate, and to boost the willingness in society to give wide scope for innovation. Yet, to foreshadow a little bit what's coming, the prevalence of modern values is not necessarily sufficient. There may be countervailing values in the nation. Opponents of innovation may stifle the expression of modern values. The book documents that the modern values arose with the onset of what Jacques Barzin termed the modern era, roughly from 1490 to 1940, from the late Renaissance up through the Enlightenment. The book argues that these values parallel the elements in the modern conception of the good life, the basic concept of which started with Aristotle. There was Pico, there was Martin Luther, Montaigne, Cervantes, Shakespeare, Hume, Hegel, Kierkegaard, Nietzsche, William James, Henri Bergson. They all contributed to this modern conception of the good life. Philosophers and humanists use the word flourishing to characterize this substance of the good life. I believe that the sort of prospering that came to the economies of dynamism in the 19th century is a perfect specimen of what philosophers and humanists meant by flourishing. Of course, this philosophical heritage belonged to the world, and certainly to all of the Western nations. But it is implicit in the book's thesis that some nations did not embrace it strongly enough to incorporate it into their values, the values that they act on. Ultimately, as the 20th century came, severe reactions against the modern economies occurred. The fluctuations and disparities in outcomes, typical of modern economies, and the endemic unemployment caused a socialist reaction to those economies. Some nations moved part of the way toward a socialist economy, seeing more planning and more extensive state ownership as a step on the way to greater stability, equality, and employment. Generally speaking, the socialists sought the greater development of people's capacities to produce, but showed no consideration or awareness of the deeper goals of individuals, the non-material rewards deriving from a life of self-expression, such as exploration and creativity. The socialist theoreticians failed to provide for innovation. In another critique, the rudderlessness and the social upheavals wrought by modern economies caused a corporatist reaction, a reaction having overtones of the traditional values found in the Middle Ages, the feudal economies, and even the mercantile economies of later centuries. Corporatists hated new enterprises invading towns, hated new money upsetting traditional ways, wealth, and status. And they hated the lack of society's control over the economy. The essence of corporatist thought, in my opinion, was the profound revolt against individualism and self-expression. For corporatists, what mattered was the good of the nation, not the individual. And the government got to decide what is good for the nation. The corporatist economy that the corporatists built replaced competition and the market with a tripartite or multipartite system of pressure groups interfacing with each other and with the state. The corporatist institutions and policies aimed at coordination across the economy, social protection, and significant control over some industries. These economies were also famous for their patronage and lobbying, not to mention cronyism and nepotism. Corporatists such as Mussolini promised innovation and thus higher dynamism without actually arranging for it. Though corporatists and socialists claimed their systems would boost economic performance on their measures of it. The data show otherwise. Socialist economies did not excel at employment. Corporatist economies did not excel at growth. These economies proved so woefully lacking in innovation, indigenous or even exogenous, that they were unable to realize their own goals. Now, this thesis about the role of modern values is tested in the book by using the prevalence of certain values, beliefs, and attitudes reported in household surveys to represent the strength of modern values, and using job satisfaction, reported job satisfaction in the household surveys, as a measure of flourishing. If the thesis is right, we should expect that a population subscribing to modern values will forge enterprises, careers, and jobs that are interesting, involve initiative, offer change, and present challenges, such as competition. What were the statistical results, looking at 18 countries in the OECD? It was found that nations scoring strongly in modern values do tend to score rather high in job satisfaction. Evidently, they develop economies with enough dynamism to generate the jobs and careers and enterprises that will enable them to flourish. Nations where values are prevailingly traditional tend to report mediocre or poor job satisfaction. Now, in the post-war period, the nations that had strayed from the from the modern regained considerable economic growth for a time. But mounting evidence as the post-war years wore on, mounting evidence of a deterioration in dynamism in these economies was quite clear. In Britain and Germany, later France, the damage to indigenous innovation appears to have been severe, though concealed by continuing technological transfers from America as long as the supply lasted, which was about the late 1990s. In America, America was no exception. Growth of productivity there, to be technically correct, I should say total factor productivity, output per basket of capital and labor, was almost halved, almost cut in half, between the period 1922 to 72 and the period 1973 to 2012. The exception was the years of the internet build out between 1996 and 2004. But that's over now. In all these nations, Britain, Germany, France, America, unemployment expanded following the slow innovation, and previous gains in inclusion were lost. Apparently, indigenous innovation, one infers from the slowdown of productivity, that indigenous innovation has sagged, dragging job satisfaction down with it, not only in America, but across all the once dynamic nations. What caused the decline of dynamism and innovation? One of my hypotheses here is that there has been an enormous rise of materialism and also an enormous and I think in part in response to that, a rise in the sense of entitlement in nations, including the once dynamic nations. I think the rise of materialism helps to explain the tremendous rise of short-termism in corporations in recent decades. The management of the corporations are just in it for the money, unlike the founding entrepreneurs who created the corporations decades earlier. And maybe we can talk more about that in the questions and answers. What may be also very important, I believe it's very important, is that while modern values may have been holding up between even in this period of slow innovation, there has been a resurgence of traditional or anti-modern values. As a result, I believe a new corporatism has come to the American economy. In this corporatism, companies are less interested in innovation than in rent seeking. They'd rather spend their time trying to land government contracts than taking a chance on developing new methods or new product lines. Elites and governments play a large role influencing the direction of a nation's attempts at innovating, and those who would like to try to develop their own ideas must overcome the increased pull of family and friends and the greater prestige of other sorts of lives. I would also add that by focusing on material objectives, conventional partisans of both corporatism and capitalism are missing the point that it is the non-material rewards of the modern economies, which were modern capitalist economies, the good life that it made possible, that are their distinctive gift to societies. A good economy is not one that assures a level of inclusion one must be clear about the good and the just, both are important. A good economy does not necessarily assure a certain level of inclusion or even productivity growth, but it does permit and foster the good life, a life of flourishing for its participants. The materialist formulations, I believe, both from the left and from the light and from the right, overlook the world of creation, of exploring and imagining, and the resulting personal growth. The good life is a wild ride through an economy with an open future, an economy offering unimagined rewards, a life of Kierkegaardian mystery, Nietzschean challenge, and Bergsonian becoming. An economy to be not just good, but also just, must offer the opportunities for the good life to those, must offer opportunity for a good life to everybody, and in particular, an economy that is just in the sense of John Rawls will have government policies that raise the prospects of prospering, of flourishing, of people whose prospects are the poorest to as high a level as possible. Let me conclude by saying that if, in order to regain the West's past glory and to resuscitate the good economy, widespread indigenous innovation and grassroots dynamism must be restored. Institutional and policy fixes can help, but the economy is not a machine that can be cranked up or down at will. It is a living, organic entity composed of all those individuals who participate in it and their ideas and their culture. The mix of modern values that first brought forth the modern economies must be reaffirmed and strengthened if the nations of the West are to regain mass flourishing. Thank you.
I'm now delighted to be able to give the floor to Anthony Grayling to give us some initial reflections on Ned's work.
Thank you very much indeed, Professor Golden. Well, my remit is to be brief, so I'll talk fast. and also just to mention a few thoughts among many prompted by Professor Phelps's thesis. This being Oxford, you were all, of course, reading Aristotle in the bath last night, so you will remember vividly what he says in connection with the transition from his great work, The Nicomachean and Ethics, and the work that follows it in the canon, which is The Politics. Because Aristotle himself said that our considerations about what kind of society, what kind of community we construct must be very sensitive to the question of how individuals might achieve for themselves the good and flourishing life, the life of eudaimonia. And this is a theme, of course, which runs through all our thinking about matters ranging from, on the one hand, questions of social justice to questions of how individuals might really come to choose and to live lives which feel good to live, which are full of achievement and creativity, which feel as if they are lived in the color and shape of values that matter to the individual himself or herself, but which are also, of course, good in their impact on others as well. And this range of concerns has within it a tension. The tension on the one hand about how the community as a whole, the polis, the political entity, relates to those interests that individuals have. A very familiar point, or very often discussed, is the question of whether aggregate flourishing of a society, or more particularly perhaps in an economy, isn't sometimes in tension with the individual flourishing of people who live within the purview of that economy. So it might be, for example, if you have a very deregulated economy, one where entrepreneurship and innovation can really take wing and where new ideas can flourish and find application, that in those circumstances, certain sorts of protections for individuals who don't have innovative skills or who are not as energetic or for historical reasons don't have opportunities to get the education required, whether that kind of economy, the relatively deregulated economy, wouldn't be one which involves some drawbacks for people who are less advantaged in those different ways. And this is an anxiety, and it's one which is very often mentioned and sometimes even canvassed in talking about the contrast between, for example, US-style economic activity and European-style economic activity, which is very often criticized for being overly conscious of the need to try to be as inclusive as possible, not to let too many fall too far by the wayside, to try to give access to more people to social goods and opportunities by equalizing some of the distribution of goods in society. And this is a very familiar contrast, and it bears on the question, where are we to locate our concept of flourishing? Where does it apply? Does it apply at the aggregate level? Is it the society as a whole, the economy in particular, for which, of course, metrics exist, GDP and overall wealth generation in a society? much enhanced, and we know this, as there's plenty of empirical and historical data in support of it, if genuine economic creativity is permitted by the absence of regulations that might inhibit it? Or do we locate the application of our concept of flourishing at the individual level, where it's not only economic activity, but a whole range of other things that might bring satisfaction to individuals apply? Now, I very, very much agree with Professor Phelps that the idea, I think, on which the idea of innovation is itself predicated, that is the idea that a good, well-lived, happy life is very often a life of making and doing, and of having the opportunity to be creative, the opportunity to have an idea and really put it to work and to have the great satisfaction of seeing it itself flourish. I very much agree with that. I wonder whether all the making and doing that individuals go into, the making of children, the painting of pictures, the writing of books, the thinking of great thoughts, being very good at surfing or rollerblading, I wonder whether all those things which might be satisfactory enterprises, because they might feel active and creative, are necessarily themselves economically productive, or whether they depend upon there being a level of economic welfare generalized in society that makes it possible for people to have the leisure in which they can do those things. We remember, since we were reading Aristotle in the Bath last night, what he says about education. He says, we educate ourselves so that we can make a noble use of our leisure. Of course, it was always the view taken in classical antiquity that our actual working lives, and of course if we were unlucky they would be rather laborious ones, were instrumental merely. They weren't an end in themselves, and they weren't a part themselves of the good. Another thing I agree with Professor Phelps about is that work can itself be part of a satisfying life if you love your work. It's an interesting point, this, isn't it, that if one is very successful, particularly in education, it gives rise to the opportunity to have a career, an endeavor that one passionately loves, so one rises every morning, and rather, as that wonderful Chinese saying has it, you leap from your bed and hasten swift as a thirsty cat to your work because you so enjoy it, and every day is full of pleasure because you love what you do. And that certainly would be a flourishing life. It doesn't appear to me absolutely necessary, however, that the flourishing in question is annexed only to one aspect of one's endeavor, but also to what it makes possible. Because if you think about what economic activity results in, that is, in the creation of wealth, and you think then what you mean by wealth, which of course is not just worth, not just the cash value of assets which are created by that endeavor, but social and cultural wealth, the resources which, if used, really do enhance the experience of life, both of individuals and of the society in aggregate. If you think in those terms, then you see that there is this larger picture, this larger jigsaw puzzle, in which a number of other elements enter into thinking about this peculiarly ethical concept, the concept of a good and well-lived life. You have to remember, of course, that ethical reflection is sometimes very subversive of conventional moralities. There are many people in this room who will have been alive when gay people, for example, were locked up in prison for loving one another. We now have a much more humane, generous, and inclusive attitude on these matters, happily, as a result of better ethical thinking about bad conventional morality. So when we are thinking about ethical values, about the values of lives well lived, lives that feel good to live, lives that have an overall quality of what Aristotle called eudaimonia, that is the sense of well-being and well-doing, of living to a purpose that matters, then one is reminded of a key point, and it's the point on which I conclude. And that is that the diversity of human nature is such that there are many, many kinds of good and flourishing lives, concordant with the talents that people have for living or making them. You know, I'm very often asked by cab drivers in London what I do, and when I tell them I teach philosophy, after that pause where they're thinking to themselves, what the heck does a philosopher do when he gets up in the morning, when that thought has passed through their minds, they ask me, well then, what's the meaning of life? And I tell them that I know the answer to that, and the answer is, it's what we make it, each of us individually. There's not a one-size-fits-all meaning of life. There are lots of individual senses of flourishing, of well-being and well-doing. And when one thinks about the question of flourishing, and when one thinks about the kind of society, and along with that, the kind of economy that would promote flourishing at the individual level, that fact about diversity and about the great range of differences there are in the talents that we all have for making and living good and flourishing lives has to be taken into account. Thank you very much. Thank you.